Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's HandyLink. You're listening to HandyLink on CJAM 99.1 FM, Windsor, Detroit.
Hello and welcome to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Teresa Warner from the National Urea-Cycle Disorders Foundation. Tell me a little bit about the foundation.
So the National Urea-Cycle Disorder Foundation is a advocacy and research-based organization that is trying our best to find a cure for a battery of urea cycle disorders. And over the past 20 years, we've gone from a parent support group to an advocacy group to really an important piece of funding to find a cure for our small community.
So, can you give me an idea of how these disorders might affect a person?
Someone with a urea cycle disorder, it can appear at different ages. So, at sometimes a child is born and they have what we call neonatal onset, which means that they will show symptoms as soon as they're born. And if they're not treated immediately, the ammonia in their system will elevate, which will cause seizures, could cause death, coma. If it's caught early enough through a battery of tests, and actually it's a very simple test, but it's usually missed because it's not one of the tests that a neonatal unit would actually look for, but a simple test called an ammonia level would actually be one of the indicators that would tell them that they have a baby with a urea cycle disorder. The infants they'll not eat, they'll become lethargic, and sometimes patients are a little bit older, and it's called late onset, and that can happen from a year old up until adulthood, and that can be triggered by many different things. It could be some type of virus that they get that could cause it. It could be caused by a high-protein meal. It could be caused by taking a steroid medication. So it comes in lots of different, we have the neonatal, which is the most severe, and then we have the late onset. And so they're a little different, and we have to treat them differently depending on when the patient is actually diagnosed.
So in the foundation's work, have there been any challenges?
Yes. The number one challenge is our community is very small, and with all of the rare disease, with the rare disease community, we're dealing with such a small population that just finding the resources to get the help that we need, we're just not on the radar. And so what we have tried to do is align ourselves with other small diseases, rare diseases, and create an alliance so that we are more unified and we can use the resources from each other to try to create awareness. It's been a long journey trying to position ourselves to where we can get the awareness that we need, also get the funding that we need, and more importantly is we want to find a cure. And we have to let those people that are in the position to help us find a cure, we have to let them know about us. We have to work really tightly with them so that we can... So they know how important the cure is for us and also so that we can support the work that they're doing. So aligning ourselves with research facilities, some pharmaceutical companies that are willing to take on our small community is extremely important.
So to look at the converse side of things, in your time with the foundation, has there been any one success that stood out for you?
Oh, there's been many. Oh, over 20 years. Awareness. We are saving children. We are saving adults. Where when we first started, when I first started with the foundation 16 years ago, that the diagnosis of urea cycle disorder was a death diagnosis. It really was. And when we were told about my daughter, the outlook didn't look good. And today, the outlook looks good. I mean, we know how to treat these children and these adults with the right medication. We can treat them, and they can live a very productive, full life. So that's most important. Second is the doctors that we now have that we partnered with. They have made treatment and diagnosis more available to families that, different parts of the world and different parts of and underserved populations are now being able to have their children be diagnosed when we just didn't have the ability to do that before. And then we've had some new medications. We have a pharmaceutical company that has developed a new medication that is changing the way our patients live day to day. So their daily life has been changed. So those are three, but there's numerous. But those are the ones that, for me, are most important.
So, are there any projects on the horizon for the foundation?
We have a long list, but I would say the number one is, and it sounds like pie in the sky, but it's the way we think. It's a cure. It's number one. Number one is finding the cure, and I really feel like we're so close. I feel like we have partnerships and alignment, and it just seems like the time is right, based on our research and our funding, that it's coming, and we just have to. It seems like every day this could be the day that we find what we can use for a cure. So that's number one, and the other thing is just continuing to raise awareness. The more awareness we have, the more babies we can save, the more families that we can change. And, creating awareness seems like an easy thing to do, but it is slow in the medical community because with rare diseases, they are all so unique, and there's nuances to each one that make them, one size doesn't fit all. And even with our condition, everyone doesn't look the same when it comes to the symptoms that they show. But there are a few things that can be done that could be part of an easy protocol. So if someone comes to an emergency room or someone exhibits a certain type of symptom, there are a few things that we are trying to create awareness so that emergency rooms will automatically know, okay, we need to do an ammonia test. Or regular physicians or family physicians would think first, maybe not misdiagnosing a patient with some type of learning disability or ADHD or autism, that they would take the next step and look, maybe if we were to run some tests, maybe we might find something else. And I think it's easy in our society today to label children with conditions that are easy, like autism or ADHD or any of those. And a lot of times what we're finding is these children, never had those. It was one of the rare diseases. And so that, of course, is very important to us. And then, developing new treatments. We have a new medication that many of our patients are using, and it's changing lives, but it's I think that we can have a better medication. But on top of that, a cure. The cure, we don't need a medication. So, again, that's why finding a cure is number one.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Okay.
I think Teresa and the foundation had exactly the right idea, in so much as for these smaller organizations, they don't have the personnel or the resources to make as much of an impact as they would hope. The right thing to do is to join with others. Some of the methodologies, some of the practices might be slightly different. The fact is, it's all about the same thing, providing the best opportunities possible for individuals with disabilities. And we as a society can do more together than we could on our own. And recognizing that we share a common purpose, putting aside ego or vanity or the idea one's solution to a problem might be the best and only answer. In some cases, it might very well be. But the only way for progress to be made is to keep an open mind, to listen to the opinions and the ideas of others. You might not embrace their methodology entirely, but you can learn from other perspectives. Working with other organizations, just to see what commonalities there are. I'm working towards solutions that can work across the board. It's absolutely the right approach. The fact is, when it comes to disability practices and policies, it is always about monitoring. It's about establishing the best policies we can, but also making sure those policies are really working, making sure that all that can be done is being done. It's fine to have a set of practices on paper. Many organizations do. Working together, working on an individual level, you can see how these policies and practices are really benefiting lives, really making an impact. Every disability group should bring it down to the human level to see how their work is benefiting at least someone out there. HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Well, I've known Nick since I was probably about 9 or 10 years old.
He was supposed to be my best man in my wedding.
He loved basketball above all else. He loved it.
The Nick Dragicevich Memorial Tournament on May 8th, 9th, and 10th in Windsor, Ontario, Canada. All age groups are welcome. To register for more info, call 519-564-1446. Registration deadline is April 24th.
It's Lillard! He got the shot off!
Nick Dragicevich Memorial Tournament.
What brings community together.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Teresa Warner from the National Urea Cycle Disorders Foundation. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Dr. Gail Demler, an expert on CMV. So tell me a little bit about your background dealing with CMV.
Well, I am a pediatric infectious diseases doctor and a professor of pediatrics at Baylor College of Medicine and Texas Children's Hospital here in Houston, Texas. And I have over 30 years experience doing research on the virus and taking care of children and their families who are affected by congenital CMV.
So how does the condition typically affect a person?
Well, CMV is actually very common. In fact, it's the most common virus most people have never heard of. Most people who are infected with CMV, which is about 80% of the general population if you live long enough, the infection is silent and you have no symptoms at all from CMV. However, if you are pregnant and catch CMV for the first time, then the virus can be transmitted to your fetus. And if you are a baby born with CMV, that's called congenital CMV infection, you can have a silent infection and have no problems, but you also are at serious risk for the virus involving your brain, your hearing, your vision, and can long-term affect your development, your motor skills, your ability to hear, and your ability to see.
So, are there any screening methods to protect these children?
Right now, it is not routine to screen all newborns routinely for congenital CMV infection. However, there are many CMV experts and many CMV families who do feel at this time it would be a good idea. And we're trying to move forward to put CMV on the recommended universal screening panel. But right now, we're not at that point. However, many hospitals and many CMV experts are now screening babies who fail their newborn hearing screen, for example, for CMV, because CMV is a common cause of non-genetic hearing loss. Babies who have microcephaly or small heads or who are born with certain signs and symptoms should also be tested for congenital CMV.
So, are there any treatments available once someone is diagnosed?
Yes, a baby who has confirmed congenital CMV infection can be treated. There are antiviral medications with very good activity against CMV. One medicine can be given IV in the hospital. That's called ganciclovir. And the other medicine is valganciclovir, so it's a sister medicine to the IV form, which can be given very easily by mouth twice a day as an outpatient. And these treatments have really made a positive impact on the outcomes of these children with congenital CMV. Actually this week, there was an original article in the New England Journal of Medicine about valganciclovir for symptomatic congenital CMV disease from a multi-center group, confirming that there is definite benefit for early treatment. So, yes. Treatment can be initiated, can improve their hearing, can improve their development.
So you mentioned steps are being taken to get it on the screening registry. What steps specifically are underway?
Right now we have an informal panel that's convened and met a few times. We have also participated in some of the webinars and communicated with the leadership of the RUSP panel. There's a process in place where a specific condition is nominated to be considered for being on the routine universal screening panel. Then a panel of experts reviews the application, and then it's voted to be included or not. So there's quite a lengthy process. We started it, but we haven't made the formal application yet.
So in your time working with those affected with CMV, has there been any success that stood out for you?
Working with over the past three decades with congenital CMV, what are some of the success stories? I think we've had several. One is breaking the silence about CMV. I've seen through the past few decades, actually in the past maybe 5 years, a groundswelling of interest of people actually being aware of CMV, that I'm seeing it be more commonly appreciated by the public. That's a positive thing. I've seen antiviral treatment now be validated and in use clinically. And I've also now seen prevention measures being advocated, not just by CMV experts, but also by public health officials, by our Centers for Disease Control. And I've seen now CMV actually becoming the law in some states. Utah recently passed a law advocating CMV awareness for pregnant women and their physicians, and CMV testing for babies who fail their newborn hearing screen, and families whose babies do have congenital CMV, that they are informed about available treatment methods. So I've seen a lot of progress through the decades. Here there's several states now following Utah's DMV. It's the law lead, if you will. Hawaii and Connecticut have bills in committee. Texas, we have bills now in committee. Two other states, Tennessee and Illinois, I believe, also are trying to get bills in committee to be voted to make it state law that women who are pregnant are aware of the CMV precautions that can be done to reduce their risk of acquiring CMV during pregnancy. Their doctors are aware of it and can educate them. And the newborns who do have the infection are offered appropriate antiviral therapy. So those are the good things. That's the progress I've seen made over the past 3 decades.
So can you elaborate a little bit on preventative measures?
Yes, I'd love to. Like I said at the beginning of the interview, CMV is the most common virus that most people have never heard of. And it's absolutely tragic for a woman who hears about CMV for the first time when she delivers her baby and her baby has signs and symptoms of the disease. That should not happen. Randomized clinical trials, good evidence-based medicine, have shown here in this country and also studies conducted in many countries around the world now have shown to reduce the risk of CMV during pregnancy. And so I sort of consider it a knowledge vaccine. We don't have an injectable vaccine, but we do have a knowledge vaccine for CMV. And it contains an ounce of CMV awareness. First, you have to hear about CMV and know it exists. And 3 simple hygienic precautions. We do know that toddlers are hot zones for CMV. They often will unknowingly transmit the virus to their moms who are pregnant. And so by reducing that transmission risk through do not share food or drink with your toddler, do not share wet, sloppy kisses with your toddler, give them a big hug and a kiss on top of their head, and wash your hands carefully after changing their diapers or wiping their runny noses or their drool from their mouth. Those simple precautions, they're not high-tech. They're very simple. They're common sense. But they have been shown through medical research to reduce the woman's risk of catching CMV. So that's in a nutshell what would probably reduce the major public health impact of CMV until we have an injectable vaccine.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
This is one of the areas I feel the most strongly about concerning disability issues. Prevention, screening, taking whatever steps you can to welcome new life into the world, healthy and happy, having the best chance to survive, to grow, to thrive. It's so simple as hand washing or not sharing food. These are methods that anybody can take to reduce their risk. What it comes down to is taking one simple action for one moment in time, but giving better opportunity to a young one throughout their lifetime. If a doctor doesn't know about this condition, they're obviously not in a position to treat it, but that's where the medical establishment and we as a society have to work together to be informed, to be as well-versed as we can into these matters. I'm not saying we're going to know everything about everything. That's impossible. But if we take the 5 minutes to learn these precautions, we can better the quality of life these young ones coming into the world. My opinion, screening for all we can should just be automatic. I mean, might take a little time, a few extra days in the hospital, but it's worth it if you reduce as much risk as you possibly can. If you take care of these issues early on, before they grow into something that could be a lifetime of complications. If it's something we can deal with in an instant, why in the world wouldn't we do this? I think it's reasonable to say the hope and the goal of every parent is to see their child thrive and succeed in the world. And with that new life comes a great responsibility to make sure they have the right tools, the right opportunities to succeed. Health is the basis of all that. If a person has their health, they can proceed from there, learn to grow stronger, smarter, and see what they can achieve in the world. But it is a parent's responsibility to ask questions of their doctors, to say, I want to understand this. I want to know why you're doing this or that test to my child. I want to know if there's any option to treat any condition you may find. I want to know what the risks are. I want to know what the benefits are. And that is not out of line at all. Fact is, doctors are just people. And they're providing service to these young ones, their families. And as a parent, guardian, or caregiver, it is your right to know. It is your right to ask. The doctor seems impatient because he has to take 5 minutes to explain something. So be it. It's better that you understand and don't take the wrong step, or that you take all the precautions you need to. It is by no means unreasonable for a parent to expect reliable, accurate information, to understand the precautions, to understand the steps that should and should not be taken. It should be just something that happens by default. People should be able to trust that those in the medical profession are not only competent, but well-informed. Learning is always a progressive process, and a doctor in practice who thinks they know everything is just deluding themselves. They have to keep up to date, up to speed. They have to have the information that says this new treatment for this condition's come out, or there's some research going on that shows some promise. And maybe it's all in the development stages, but you can use that. You can provide some hope. You can say, I might not have all the answers, but if you contact this agency, this organization, they might be able to provide some referrals. They might be able to help you understand. Ego simply can't win in the medical profession. Just can't. A doctor who believes that their opinion is the end-all and be-all, they run a serious risk, folks. They run the risk of not giving their patient what they need, the right opportunities, the right treatments. However, on the converse side, one who keeps an open mind, both a caregiver and a doctor, and they work together to find the best options, can inevitably give the right path for a child coming into the world. Regardless of what the condition may be, folks, I believe there's hope for everyone. I believe that there's always that way of, if not curing a condition, to improve the quality of life, to make things just a little bit better. And if we do that progressively, and the opportunities continue to grow and develop. And that is the very definition of progress. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal, so get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.